Hello, and happy Sunday. Thank you for tuning in to this March 14th edition of The Rewind, your Sunday news magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kaplan. On today's episode, we delve into Tisch College's research on the state of civic education in Massachusetts and at the national level. Also, we bring an update on the Pedagogical Partnership Program, a program now in its second semester that pairs students with faculty to promote equity and improve academic experiences. But first, let's talk with Jack Maniacci about Tufts' early decision applications. Hello, Jack. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Let's get started. So we're here to talk about two consequential effects of the pandemic on admissions, especially the applicant pool and standardized testing policy. So let's start with the first. Can you tell us a little bit about the differences between the pandemic era applicant pool that we're seeing go through now and recent years?
Yeah, so what we're actually seeing now is a pretty big increase in the applicant pool for this year. The early decision applicants are up 19% from last year, and these 2 years together are up just a little bit more from before the pandemic years. And I think that, you know, part of this might be from a group of people who chose to take a gap year or the differences that the pandemic has brought to education. So people who are reapplying, increasing the numbers there, but also, I mean, we were seeing growth before this year anyway, so I think it's a combination of factors that are leading to this increase.
What about among specific categories of demographics, first-generation college students, for example, or international students? What are the changes along those groups?
Yeah, so actually these groups are increasing, even among the increasing general applicant pool. Some of these groups are exceeding the growth rate in general. Others are at least keeping pace with it. And that's kind of led to labels of this applicant pool as being much more diverse and just an increase in diversity in recent years.
Sure. And that also includes in the general applicant pool, students of color and Latinx students and stuff like that, right?
Yes.
From sources that you've talked to, are there any possible explanations for those increases in applications above the trend?
Yeah, so actually, if you look at an article from Tufts Now from January, they talked about how there are much more applicants from different regions of the country, a lot more applicants from the Southwest and the Midwest, as well as a lot of international growth. Different countries are sending more students.
Another aspect of admissions that's really changed a lot in light of the COVID-19 pandemic is the policy regarding standardized test scores. Could you tell us a little about the changes there?
Yes, so this year Tufts went without requiring standardized test scores. The goal was to accommodate students who would have difficulty finding an opportunity to take these tests because of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a lot of cases, there were not opportunities for students. And a lot of students took advantage of this change. 52% did not submit any standardized testing. And you know, what I heard from admissions, it seems like this has been pretty effective. JT Duck cited that there's a harmony of percentages of people who did send scores and people who did not, which is kind of showing how it is pretty effective in, you know, accommodating students.
And that's coming from JT Duck, the dean of admissions, right?
Yes, that's right.
So what is the rationale for this new test optional policy?
Basically, what I heard was the changes that admissions made to the standardized testing requirement is mostly a way to, like I said, accommodate students who would have a more difficult time finding opportunities to take these tests during the pandemic. But seeing that there's been sort of a trend, even before the pandemic, of colleges changing their rules surrounding these requirements, it's possible that Tufts will, you know, keep this policy in years going forward.
So considering that some schools adopted a test optional policy even before the pandemic, what does the future of test optional at Tufts look like? Is this a short-term trial run or where is this going?
Yeah, I can't say anything for certain now, but that is the language that was used in the statement from admissions, that this was sort of a trial. But from what they said, it seems like there was a lot of success and that this is a good way to accommodate students and a good way to make admissions more equal for opportunity. And I think it's likely that we'll see a continuation of this policy.
Is there anything to indicate from your conversation with sources and reporting on this that the introduction of the test optional policy is partly responsible for the increase in the size of the applicant pool and the diversity of the applicant pool? Do you think that the two are related?
I don't think I found anything that could really link those two changes for certain.
Fair enough. Now that there is an admissions review that for many students doesn't involve a standardized test score, how does that affect the way that Tufts admissions reviews applications?
So this is something that they highlighted in the statement from admissions. They're being careful not to give students who did submit test scores a large advantage from it, and they're not trying to give any disadvantage to students who did not. Definitely trying to equalize the percentages of students who are admitted from either category. It makes me think of sort of interviews in the college application process. I think a lot of times what you'll hear is that it can't really hurt you not to do one, and it doesn't exactly, you know, make your application if you do get one. So yeah, I'm not exactly sure if we could say now, submitting a test score is meaningless anymore, but the admissions department is doing work to make sure that students aren't being considered differently either way.
Sure. What are the sorts of responses among students already enrolled, knowing about the application process, or maybe more importantly, students who have applied to the introduction of the test optional policy?
I personally haven't heard from Tufts applicants or new students about the changes to the standardized testing policy. One could argue against the policy, talking about how, you know, the merit of getting in based on good test scores and how it kind of invalidates students who did so. But I haven't heard anything from any students themselves. I do think that if we continue to see more applicants, then the lack of a standardized testing requirement might be responsible for that.
Just to make sure there's nothing missed here, are there any other changes to the admissions process as a result of the pandemic?
Yeah, this year we actually did see the ED1 deadline pushed back from November 1st to November 17th, but the ED2 deadline stayed at January 1st.
We just did some final numbers. What were the numbers on early decision applicants, total applications, and increase over last year?
So this year there were over 3,000 students who applied via early decision. Last year, it was just over 2,500, which means there was about a 19% increase.
All right, marvelous. Well, it's been great having you here. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me on.
The 2020-2021 application cycle saw an overall 35% increase in applications over last year, with more than 31,000 applications received by Tufts. For the first time, standing at 51%, a majority of applications came from students of color. 48% of the admitted Early Decision 1 applicants from the U.S. are students of color. Last semester, the Center for the Enhancement of Learning and Teaching launched the Pedagogical Partnership Program, a student-led initiative that pairs faculty and students in classroom settings. The program's creators say the Pedagogical Partnership Program serves as a tool to amplify and empower student voices in the classroom. Ryan Schaefer has the story.
The Pedagogical Partnership Program, or P3, was first launched last semester after a trial period over the summer. Now in its second semester, the program has doubled in size, growing from 5 to 11 student-faculty partnerships. Administered through the Center for the Enhancement of Learning and Teaching, or CELT, P3 seeks to promote student engagement, equity, and learning outcomes in classrooms through semester-long partnerships between student and faculty. Senior Jillian Impostato, one of the program's founders and co-coordinators, said the program aims to amplify student voices in the classroom while also connecting teaching faculty to CELT.
Specifically, it's looking to make it's a student empowerment and professional development to make Tufts classrooms more equitable and engaging for all students. We want this to be feedback that can be worked on directly, like thought about directly throughout the semester instead of just when the semester ends. And hopefully this is just like a really great resource for faculty members in all phases of their careers. So we have some early career, we have some late career faculty members, just get them thinking about pedagogy in a new way, because this is a new program to Tufts, and I think it's been doing, I know it's been doing a lot of good in developing relationships between faculty members and students, which is especially hard during a pandemic.
In the program, each student is paired with a faculty member and attends one of their classes each week. The student and professor also meet once a week to share ideas and ask questions about inclusivity and student performance. From her own experience as a student partner during the P3's pilot program, Empastado said these conversations leave a lasting impact.
But this summer, I was with Professor Aaron Seaton, who was teaching an education course on human development and learning. And a lot of our conversations had to do with a faculty member's role in when to jump in on a conversation that could be derailed, or a student that could possibly say something that was offensive. And when is it like other students' roles within this even virtual classroom community to step in? So I think that just my observations and my probing questions definitely changed the way that she looked at her classroom. And she says that it's still impacting, like our conversations still have, she's seen the impacts on all of the classes she's taught since then, which is really exciting.
This semester, the program is led by Empastado and junior Michelle Nguyen. And currently, there are faculty partners representing the departments of mechanical engineering, physics, religion, sociology, and education, as well as the School of the Museum of Fine Arts at Tufts. The program is based on a model of revolving leadership and participation, where one new co-coordinator is selected each year as another leaves or graduates. As for faculty, the aim is to have new professors inaugurated each semester. Empastado says this approach broadens P3's impact on campus.
We're trying to incorporate, like, to touch so many different disciplines at Tufts and increase our impact across campus, and especially thinking about, we had to really focus on student recruitment this semester since we were more than doubling the amount of students we had, but now we can really focus on professors that maybe have not utilized CELT resources in the past. For the first few semesters, it was definitely people that have had working relationships with Annie Soyson and Ryan Rideau, who are the director and associate director of CELT, that have been helping the program.
Most of the students involved are first generation, low income, or students of color, and some have learning disabilities. As a group, the students meet once a week to compare notes and talk through issues of inclusivity and different educational approaches. Unlike faculty partners, who are new each semester, students are encouraged to stay on as new members are recruited.
So it's great to have a mix of old and new student partners, returning and new student partners, so they can share their experiences. So that's a whole component of the cohort, to be like, this is a problem I'm facing. And then I and my co-facilitator, Michelle, and also returning students can give a little input and a lot of different reflection activities and some guest speakers to get a basis of knowledge around social emotional learning, critical race theory in education, universal design in learning. So some topics like that. So getting people usually from the Tufts community to come and speak. It's something we did last semester that we're hoping to continue to do this semester.
Funding for the program comes from a one-year springboard grant run through Tufts Office of the Provost for Research and an external two-year grant from the Davis Educational Foundation. All the funding goes toward compensating student partners and coordinators. Though the grant comes with expiration dates, Empastado is optimistic about P3's future.
I'm very optimistic that this program will, knock on wood, continue for many years to come. So the Springboard Grant and the Davis Family Foundation Grant were a great start. And our partnership with CELT is really important because they have their own budget and are supportive in so many ways, financially and otherwise. But our partnership with CELT can also connect us with administrators that can help us to get more sustainable funding. So I can't give you specifics on where that's coming from and like definites, but from what I've heard, it's hopeful.
Empastado said interested faculty can expect to see applications coming out soon alongside a few information sessions. For The Rewind, I'm Ryan Schaefer.
In the news this week, the CDC has issued guidance for fully vaccinated individuals. The new guidance says that small groups of vaccinated people can gather maskless, though it also cautions against air travel and travel on trains. After 9 terms in office, Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone has announced he will not run for another term, fueling speculation that he's considering a run against Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker in 2022. Curtatone first assumed office in 2004, and in his final midterm address, Curtatone spoke on issues of racial justice, climate change, education, and the pandemic. The Tufts Community Union Senate passed a $1.1 million Treasury resolution on March 7th. The resolution allocates TCU Treasury funds to a trust for post-pandemic campus events and celebrations. In a separate event, Tufts student Max Price, a member of the TCU judiciary, alleged that he was discriminated against and that his place in student government was threatened due to his Jewish identity. The claims come from a series of meetings between the judiciary and Tufts Students for Justice in Palestine, preparing for SJP's fall referendum. SJP had asked the judiciary that Price recuse himself from talks regarding the referendum, given Price's public statements against SJP's campaign. The referendum, which passed with 68% of the vote, called on the university to apologize for sending its police chief to a counterterrorism training course in Israel in 2017, banned two PD officers from, quote, attending programs based on military strategies, unquote, and prevent the hiring of officers who have attended these trips. To learn more about Tufts community news, be sure to visit TuftsDaily.com. Upcoming this week, Stacey Abrams will be speaking at a virtual Tisch College event on Thursday. Abrams is an author, activist, entrepreneur, and political leader, and was the first Black woman to be a major party nominee for a governorship in the United States. The Office of the Provost is hosting an event titled Global Tufts Month Panel, Who Gets to Belong in the Just and Sustainable City? A panel discussion of sustainability and justice this Friday. On Thursday at 7 p.m., you can cook alongside University President Anthony Monaco at a virtual Tusk event. One-person meal kits are available for the event. In-person students can pick up a meal kit between noon and 5 p.m. at Curtis Hall on Thursday, while remote students will be provided a gift card to purchase their own supplies. Registration is required through Tufts Tickets. Rewind reporter Ty Blitzstein spoke about the state of civic education in Massachusetts and the U.S. with Kai Kawashima Ginsburg, director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, and Nithya Badrinath of the student group Advancing Civic Thought in Our Nation. Ty Blitzstein has the story.
So I think, yeah, civics education is just basically, easily put, just learning about your community and your place in the community. It's something that should be accessible to everyone.
That's Nithya Badrinath, a junior at Tufts and the Research and Advocacy Director at ACTION, or Advancing Civic Thought in Our Nation. ACTION is a Tisch College-affiliated student group dedicated to promoting youth civic action and engagement in the greater Boston area. In other words, the group aims to make civic education more accessible. Each semester, members of the organization go into local high schools and middle schools to teach a unique civics curriculum, at least prior to the coronavirus pandemic.
So I think, like, obviously, we want to make sure that, like, so much terms, like what you learn in government and, like, those type of classes are, like, easy to understand for the younger group of students. And I think our main goal is to make sure that, like, each student knows that they have, their voices can be heard in their communities, and that any project or any issue that they have in their communities, they have the ability to go about and, like, create change.
Badrinath described just how exactly ACTION puts that mission into practice.
So basically, traditionally in classrooms, students think of an issue in their community, right? So let's say they talk about accessibility to housing, and maybe they'll say, like, oh, like, rent is too expensive in my neighborhood, or some issue like that. The idea is for them to come up with an issue, come up with a root cause of that issue, and then, like, work on a project to address that.
To create their curriculum, the leaders of ACTION worked with the Tufts Department of Education and the Jonathan M. Tisch College of Civic Life.
We have to make sure that these skills and what goes into our curriculum is accessible to students, and it's interesting and engaging. How it ties together with, like, research that, like, Circle and, like, Tisch does is obviously they found how important, like, the youth vote and, like, youth engagement in politics is, right? And we want to make sure that that is translated into the classrooms.
A lot of that research is conducted by Kay Kawashima Ginsburg, director of CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tisch College. CIRCLE is a nonpartisan, independent research organization that focuses on youth civic engagement in the United States.
in the most recent iteration, which is under my directorship for 6 years, we have really focused on how to achieve equitable paths for productive and effective citizenship among all kinds of young people, but focused in the United States.
I recently spoke with Dr. Kawashima Ginsburg about her and CIRCLE's latest research. But first, I asked her how she defines civic education.
Generally speaking, when we talk about civic education here at CIRCLE, we are generally talking about education that's happening amongst or with young people in some sort of educational setting. But the important thing is that young people are learning about the systems that surround them, usually government or cultural norms or some kind of group norms and values, and they're learning to navigate that. And that's pretty broad definition. And under that definition, frankly, we can talk anywhere between something like civics class in eighth grade in Massachusetts, which is set by law and standards, all the way to youth organizing, where young people have been found to learn a lot of these civic skills, leadership skills, communications, and planning.
In January, CIRCLE released a report about civics class, titled The State of Civic Education in Massachusetts, prepared for the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. The study focuses on the statewide awareness, understanding, and implementation of two important civic education policies, the 2018 History and Social Science Framework and the 2018 Act to Promote and Enhance Civic Engagement. These new policies include topics that Kawashima Ginsburg calls innovative and exciting, like media literacy, human rights, and social-emotional learning.
Yeah, so ultimately, we want to know how this law is impacting students' civic readiness. But it actually takes multiple steps to get there. First is, of course, that the school leaders and district administrators were aware of these changes, both in the framework and in lay language, that's standards, what you're supposed to learn about, at what grade level, and what you're supposed to be able to do, as well as kind of mandate. In this case, things like students have to do nonpartisan student-led civics project in eighth grade, and again in high school at one point. But the other important step is actually the teachers are prepared. Teachers feel supported, they understand the law, and they feel that they have the skills. And that dispositional shift has been really important in what we've watched in both Florida and Illinois.
The researchers conducted a mixed method study, which incorporated both surveys and interviews with teachers and school administrators to better understand the state of civic education in Massachusetts. Kawashima Ginsburg discussed some of the main takeaways outlined in the report.
So one of the probably most not surprisingly promising thing we found is that we have thousands of really passionate teachers that really do understand the mission of civic education, which isn't just to know things or which isn't just to act on impulse on civic matters, but actually have both of those things. They're prepared with knowledge and disposition and agency and have the skills to participate. That's what many, many, many teachers wanted to get to. And there was no question about that. And that's really promising to have that kind of core lessons around this idea of civic education.
However, there were also some less promising findings. For instance, although middle and high school teachers are aware of the policy's student-led civics project requirement, many of them face challenges in understanding where to start and how to do it. Also, due to the pandemic, the majority of teachers surveyed thought it was harder to fit in civics in a structured way, given that other subjects may need to be prioritized. As part of the report, Dr. Kawashima Ginsburg and her team made several recommendations, including providing more support to elementary educators in grades K through 5, where the integration of civic education into the curriculum is relatively new.
We also found that especially elementary teachers, but also middle and high school teachers, almost never get professional development specifically focused on civics. So that's a really clear gap that can be filled with the resources available and the community of providers coming together. And finally, the administrators, while supportive on the general idea of civics, are still needing a lot of help in understanding exactly what's required and what is actually part of their job. In making sure that the teachers are supported and the implementation of the civics law and the framework is going smoothly moving forward.
This March also marked the release of another report on civic education. The Educating for American Democracy Initiative, of which Tisch College and Circle are partners, published the Roadmap to Educating for American Democracy, a landmark cross-partisan framework which is the culmination of a more than year-long effort involving more than 300 scholars, educators, historians, and students from across the United States. Funding came from a $1.1 million grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the U.S. Department of Education. Circle's Kay Kawashima Ginsburg was one of seven principal investigators.
But my push for the group in particular was very Circle and Tisch, in that we said, what I said, as a PI, I'd really like to make sure we listen to these people that's going to be implementing these things and experiencing these inquiries.
The intense political polarization of the United States is what first gave rise to the project.
Many of us in civic education and history education are very concerned about the political polarization actually inhibiting everybody from making a lot of progress and providing great civic preparation for all students.
The researchers themselves were divided on what exactly constitutes civic education.
Because we essentially were divided by ideology of either prioritizing action as a main part of civic education or just knowing about things as part of the civic preparation. And in a way, no one was getting both comprehensively. So that's why we started the project. And in a project, we decided to take this polarization and disagreements about what's core purpose of civic education as a feature, just a feature of constitutional democracy. So what we ended up doing as a project is to create a roadmap of the kind of content themes that students should grapple with throughout their K-12 education.
Kawashima Ginsburg described the main goals of the roadmap, which she noted is not a comprehensive curriculum, but rather a guide to important points like the idea of self-governance and what it means to be the people.
The goal here is for students to develop both comprehensive knowledge of the amazing, glorious history of the United States, but also real pain points and the mistakes that were made, and students to be able to form voice and agency based on the more comprehensive understanding they can achieve by engaging in these deep inquiry, starting in early age and then continuing throughout. The goal is for us to have a new generation of young people that are truly fully prepared. And by that, we do mean that they are able to really disagree productively, still work together, have a clear idea of what they think and what they want, and have the skills to change systems if they need to, but also support the institution when it's working well. So in a way, we're really hoping that we can get everybody this well-rounded, comprehensive civic education that can truly improve our country together.
But the first sentence of the report, the United States stands at a crossroads of peril and possibility. So what role, if you could expand upon it a little bit, does civic education play in determining which one of these two directions our country takes?
Civic education is something that should be the purpose of the education itself. Because without those civic mindedness or care and commitment to improving the public and the common together, we are unable to maintain the design of the constitutional democracy. It's always called for the people to participate. That definition of the people has changed over time very, very significantly. And as a result of that, our systems and the government also needs to respond in response to the changes in demographics and the landscape. But if we can actually educate everybody because of economic inequality and racism and other social inequalities, then we're actually not meeting that constitutional promise, and we will go into that peril. So because of that, this project holds the potential of this time for real actually serving all students, regardless of where they're coming from and where they start from. So I think that's the potential. You know, the initiative is really young. As much as we've been wrecking our brains for almost 2 years, it just launched. You know, it's just really launched last week. So potentials are both unlimited and still somewhat unknown. What we do know that is that there is a lot of potential for innovation at the local and state level, and potentially sort of a national language that we can use to talk about what's important about civics, what can we agree as a common ground.
Dr. Kawashima Ginsberg shared her main takeaways from both reports. One, a look at the current state of civic education on the state level. The other, a national roadmap for the future.
I think that both of those reports say at least two things, and this is just really not rehearsed or thought out. But one is the importance of listening and kind of understanding relationship between people. This is so clear at the state level because everything's about network and how you can form a community, all the way down to classroom level with teachers and peers of students. But even at the national level, I realized that the getting to know organizations and scholars and people whom I've never met and know that I have some disagreement with on really core levels in some cases can really help us move forward. So that's really something I learned over and over again through those things. The second is the importance of language and how important it is to define it really well in advance after deliberating it to death. Not to make fun of ourselves, but it's really actually important when a language of one or two words can completely close doors.
Equity is another common theme in both reports.
Equity is simply a necessity for civic education. It's not an option. It's not an afterthought. And I say this earlier too, but our constitutional democracy was designed with people in the equation. Without that, it doesn't work. And our goal in civic education is to essentially sustain that system of government that we created in a way that's healthy and good for everybody so that society prospers, right? Then we have to make sure that the students, regardless of where they're starting, have the equal opportunity to thrive and succeed.
Actions Nithya Badrinath agrees.
Just the focus on like equity and justice is the most important thing in education.
Kay Kawashima Ginsberg acknowledged the crucial role of outside nonprofits like Action in making civic education accessible.
So these kinds of nonprofits, and especially students who are going to schools, sometimes I think on a volunteering basis, I appreciate their work for that too, I think is a really essential resource for many, many teachers. What I don't want to forget though is the teachers do have a lot of capacity, knowledge, and wisdom. So it's partnership with school.
Action knows this well.
And I think the most important thing that we learn is that we don't know as much as these students and these teachers and these principals know about their communities. And that's, we're just here to like be a guide to help these students, you know, like get where they want to be, but they are the ones that actually know everything. And we're just here helping them with providing the resources they need to like do what they want to do. In creating partnerships, we just need to emphasize that we're here, it's asset-based, like we're working on the assets of the community and like making sure that we're there to help them get where they want to be, and not that we know everything and like we're here to like tell the teachers how to run their classroom and tell the students that this is what they want to do.
At Tisch College, the current work on civic education mirrors this kind of partnership, bringing together community members, researchers, and student volunteers. For The Rewind, I'm Ty Blitstein.
And that's it for this March 14th edition of The Rewind. Join us next week for more stories from the Tufts Daily.
The Rewind is brought to you by the Tufts Daily. Today's episode was produced in part by me, McKenna Law, with reporting by Ty Blitstein and producer Ryan Schaefer. Kate Secklier selects our music. Our host is Robert Kaplan, and Hannah Harris is the executive audio producer. Thank you for listening.